O life that maketh all things new. Scholars recognize that there are two different creation stories in the book of Genesis, written by two different authors. The first is the story of the universe being spoken into existence in 7 days. Second, the story of Adam and Eve in the garden. The first story of separating the light from the dark and the waters from the land was revolutionary in its approach to creation. In human history, it was a reimagining of the nature of God. Rather than a whole pantheon of gods and goddesses fighting and struggling for control, the author of the first verses of Genesis envisioned a being so powerful that the whole universe could come into existence just by naming its will and speaking a few words aloud. As people of faith who have articulated a vision of justice, equity, and compassion, our work is to imagine a new world different from the one we know and to work for the creation of that world. But speaking a new world into existence is, of course, rarely as easy as the epic creation poem of Genesis would suggest. To be a person of faith means that we believe a different world is possible, even if it takes more than a week of work. Every day, we are imagining a universe different from our own, and with our words and actions and courage and persistence, we people of faith are trying to will that world into being. I don't know how this particular universe came into existence. I recognize in my own life, though, that the act of creation is usually complicated and beautiful, largely because the act of creation is born out of relationship and community, which are always complicated, even when beautiful. The Dudley Square neighborhood in Boston, where I've lived for 6 years now, is a gorgeous neighborhood. Rows of colorful houses with lots of green space and community gardens, community centers for children and families and people of all different backgrounds. It wasn't always this way, though. In the 1980s, after decades of white flight, divestment from developers, neglect from politicians, it was a difficult place for a lot of residents there. There were abandoned buildings and abandoned cars on every block. There were several illegal garbage dumps that filled the air with pollution. And in this relatively small area of Boston, there were 30 acres of abandoned buildings and vacant lots. A philanthropic foundation showed up with a bold new idea. Instead of spreading around their money to lots of different grants and lots of different organizations all over the place, they were going to move all of their wealth to this one neighborhood to create a sea change, real transformation in at least one place that most needed it. They hired experts to come up with a plan for better housing and a cleaner community. And with big enthusiasm, they called a neighborhood meeting. They were going to share the results of their research and share their plans for improvement with the neighborhood. The residents of the community showed up to this big meeting. They heard the plans, they listened to the research, and they rebelled. The residents of Dudley Square had not been consulted in this shared, so-called shared vision, and they'd seen what had happened in other neighborhoods, where things got fixed up without local involvement and became unaffordable for the people that had lived there. But in this moment, with one angry resident after another standing up to the microphone to yell at the poor folks upstage who had such good intentions, a small miracle happened, an act of creation. The philanthropists and experts and power brokers on a stage at the front of the room stepped out back. They retreated for a few minutes to breathe deeply. And then they came back to the community. And rather than defending the hard work they'd put in, the very real long hours, the clearly good intentions they had, they asked for a chance to start over and do it right next time. What they'd thought was the end of the creation process was just the beginning. From this first meeting, they began to form a new organization, the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative, which began a bottom-up process for reimagining their neighborhood. This organization, now led by long-term residents, was the first in the nation to bring a community together to create a plan for development and bring it to the city for their approval. They bought up the vacant lots as the first nonprofit in the country to get eminent domain status. They got rid of the abandoned cars by putting campaign stickers for the mayor on every abandoned car in the area. They got cleaned up real quick. They put together a plan for hundreds and hundreds of units of affordable housing in a land trust so that the land would always be owned by the community, owned democratically. And now their story is so successful that it is written into every city planning and community development textbook in every college in the United States. In the words of the Black Lives Matter policy platform, they came together to forge a new covenant. This is more my experience of creation, imagining new worlds or even new neighborhoods. Comes from relationship, from listening deeply to one another. If that's your experience as well, would you say out loud right now, listening deeply? Shared vision comes not so much from one brilliant individual as from making room for more conversation, particularly with the marginalized among us. If that's your experience, would you say out loud right now, making room? And community education comes from taking collective action, however clumsy and messy, and then looking back to wrestle with the results and learn from them. If that's your experience, would you say out loud right now, collective action? This kind of creation, in fact, does show up later in the Hebrew Bible. After our failed heroes are expelled from the garden, whereas the God of the first creation story is all-knowing and all-powerful, God doesn't stay this way throughout the collected works. It doesn't take long before some of the mortals in the upcoming stories are actually arguing with God and changing God's vision for how things should be. Kind of like that neighborhood meeting. In Genesis 32, Jacob literally wrestles with an angel, and he's blessed for it. In Exodus 4, God first calls upon Moses to be solely responsible for leading the Israelites out of Egypt, and Moses argues with God, convincing him that his brother Aaron should share in the leadership with him. And God, in a huff, agrees to a change of development plans. Exodus 32, God gets angry with the Israelites and says unkind things about them. We'll leave it at that. And then threatens to destroy the whole lot of them. But Moses basically reminds God to take some deep breaths and reminds God that relationships with humans are complicated. It says, and I quote, "The Lord repented of the evil for which he thought to do unto his people." When God, in Numbers 14, is angry again with the Israelites, relationships are complicated, for not behaving, Moses convinces him that the true strength, his true strength, is in forgiveness rather than violence. Let me say that again. This is a story about humans on earth convincing the Almighty God in heaven about the power of forgiveness, that another, more peaceful way is possible. This is the story of a God willing to be changed by what it started. A God who allows relationship to change its mind about what is right, alter his vision for what might be. These are the stories of an inconsistent creator. The word consistent comes from the Latin meaning to stand still. How could humanity ever write of a God that stood still, given the movement in our hearts, in our relationships, in our varied experiences of this world? We have witnessed, just this weekend, hearts moving in conflict. Several people are now dead after white supremacists marched in Charlottesville, Virginia yesterday and clashed with counter-protesters. This one incident is just part of a larger hate crime wave rising in our country ever since the announcement of Trump's candidacy for president. The Southern Poverty Law Center counted almost 900 incidences of hate or bias in the 10 days after the election. The Council on American Islamic Relations received 1,597 reports of potential bias in the first 3 months of this year and was able to verify 851 of them. Of the verified reports, about half involve abuse by federal agents. A rising wave of white supremacy isn't just about the government and its citizens continuing the American tradition of violence against people of color. And it isn't just about poor white folks in the South wanting to honor and possibly rebuild our history of slavery. It is a culture steeped here in Massachusetts as well. Here in Massachusetts, we are sixth place in the nation for wealth inequality. Here in this blue state, black folks are more likely to be stopped by the police, more likely to be interacted with physically when they are stopped, more likely to be charged with small crimes, and more likely to be given jail time if found guilty. The school-to-prison pipeline is very real here in our state as well, and it goes back as part of our heritage. Emerson, as a leading thinker in the United States, also promoted the idea that of all of the unequal races, of the white people, Saxons were the very most brilliant and the most beautiful, with their blue eyes that made them so much more beautiful than other races. He said in his journal, "The captivity of 1,000 Negroes is nothing to me compared to the absence of moral feeling in the white man." He was an abolitionist, to be sure, but out of a duty for improving the white race, which shouldn't be dirtied or sullied with such things as slavery. He compared the role of Massachusetts in the Union to the role of, quote, "every Englishman in Australia, in South Africa, in India, or in whatever barbarous country their forts and factories have set up. These Englishmen represent London, the art, the power, and the law of Europe." He saw the New England Saxon white man as a sort of beacon of brilliance and beauty. Again, from the policy platform for the Movement for Black Lives, "we have come together now because we believe it is time to forge a new covenant." If you agree, would you say out loud right now, "new covenant"? When racism is institutionalized in our systems of schooling, housing, finance, and particularly in our so-called justice system, we indeed need a new covenant. We need to imagine a country that, as Langston Hughes said, must be but has never been yet. Covenant and imagination come from listening deeply to one another, making room for conversation, and learning from our collective action. As Reverend Patricia Jimenez speaks of the imagination inherent in justice work, she says it is an opportunity to tap into the creative magic that happens when each person is encouraged and expected to be a creative agent, to tap into the creative magic that happens. She says when the response creates a new community of love and justice, we become co-creators with the divine. That's the kind of creation I can get behind, the kind of creation that invites every one of us with inherent worth and dignity, every single one of us to become a creative agent together, to imagine a new world that might be possible, a world different from the broken structures of the past. Imagination is rarely about creating something out of nothing. It's more often about bringing together disparate ideas, a mashup of previously unrelated genres. It is messy. It is born out of community and relationship. It's perhaps an oversimplification, but not untrue, to say that jazz was a new style created by bringing together African rhythm and European harmony. Blues is just a mix of Muslim melismatic song style with European and African instruments. We can go on and on the list. Every style of music ever created wasn't because of the brilliance of one person sitting alone in a studio, but of the ideas that came together across traditions, across cultures. Imagination of New Possibilities is a dynamic mix of recognizing our shared humanity, the truth that we are all one and that we have everything in common, and also the parallel truth that our lives and cultures are particular, that we can never fully know the experience of another. Nearly everything about our understanding of the world is shaped by our unique location. What's beautiful about these creation stories, and the stories of mortals arguing with God and wrestling with angels, is that we might see ourselves in them. Then when we're confronted with our own bias or assumed ways of thinking, we might step out to the back room, take a deep breath, and ask for a chance to start anew, to forge a new covenant together. We mortals shape the world around us. We give life and we nurture life. We imagine new possibilities for ourselves and for our communities, and sometimes we even speak them into being. We argue them into being. We wrestle them into being. If that's been your experience, would you say out loud right now, wrestle into being? Friends, ours is a faith that invites the creative magic into our relationships. Ours is a faith that brings us together to do together what we could not do alone. That together we can envision a world beyond what any one of us could imagine, and that together we might wrestle it into being. May it be so. Amen.